Coming up on Tech News Today, BlackBerry sells, but who's buying it? Lenovo gets more flexible for business users and Path
secretive.
All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, September 5th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by you. No, really, you. Because if you didn't watch or listen, we wouldn't do this show. So thanks. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show to keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, put them in some context for you, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day, which we like to call the news views. Occasionally. The Wall Street Journal reports BlackBerry's special committee of board members has decided to hurry up the process pursuing the sale of the company. They want to do a fast auction process with a sale completed as early as November. The journal sources say BlackBerry has narrowed its list of candidates and will begin that sales process very soon.
Hey guys, Lenovo's launching a bunch of stuff. The company's new smartphone called the Vibe X has a 6.9 millimeter slim frame. That's very slim. And a weight of just 4.2 ounces plus a 13 megapixel rear cam, 5 megapixel front cam, curved display and an HD screen. Lenovo also announced the Yoga 2 Pro, 10% lighter than previous models. It can go into four different modes with a higher resolution screen. Starts at just over $1,000. Then there's the ThinkPad Yoga, which will have a 360-degree rotation and a lift-and-lock keyboard that sits flush on surfaces with keys locked into place in multiple modes, starting around $949. But that's not all. Lenovo also announced the Flex line, two laptops that can swap modes to be a stand or laptop. That line starts at $629.
The Apple of China, Xiaomi, introduced a new Android-powered smartphone and television. The phone is the Mi3 and features a 5-inch 1080p touchscreen powered by a Tegra 4 or a Snapdragon 800, depending on which Chinese carrier you're on. The phones launch in mid-October and will range in price from about $330 to $410. The 47-inch television is called the Xiaomi TV, and it will be assembled by Wistron, which is the company that makes TVs for Sony. The TV will run Android and have 2 gigabytes of RAM, 8 gigabytes of storage, and be powered by a Snapdragon 600 processor. It's priced at around $490 and launches in mid-October.
A U.S. federal jury in Seattle has ordered Google's Motorola Mobility to pay Microsoft $14.5 million U.S. in damages for failing to license on reasonable terms patents related to the H.264 video codec and 802.11 wireless standards. Motorola sought 2.25% of the product price from Microsoft. The case will have broad effects over what constitutes fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, or FRAND, terms in patent licensing in the U.S., and of course, Google intends to appeal.
Ah, FRAND. I love FRAND. At IFA this week, Toshiba has announced the Encore, an 8-inch tablet with a 1280x800 resolution screen, and Intel's new Atom Bay Trail CPU running Windows 8.1. The Encore also has a micro HDMI port and a 32GB hard drive with an expandable micro SD storage option, a 2-megapixel front cam that's apparently optimized for Skype calls, and an 8-megapixel rear camera. It'll be available in November for $330.
Yesterday, either to capitalize on the Samsung Galaxy Gear coverage or to get buried under it, Qualcomm introduced its own smartwatch called the Talk. The Talk tethers to an Android phone via Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and uses Qualcomm's Mirasol display technology, which is kind of like a color e-ink display. Mirasol is also known to sip power compared to something like an LCD. Inside is a 200 megahertz Cortex M3 processor. That's right, 200 megahertz. And will help also save battery life. The Qualcomm Talk will cost around $300 and is targeted for an October 10th release.
Oyster has launched a limited preview of its ebook subscription service. A lot of people call it the Netflix of ebooks. The service lets you read any of more than 100,000 titles for a monthly fee of $9.95 US. The service is only available as an iPhone app in the United States for now. An iPad app is planned for this autumn. The Oyster app can store up to 10 titles at a time for offline reading.
Six consumer privacy groups, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the Center for Digital Democracy, the Consumer Watchdog, the Patient Privacy Rights, the USPIRG, and the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse have organized a coalition and sent a letter to the Federal Trade Commission asking it to block upcoming changes to Facebook's privacy policies. They say would make it easier for the social network to use personal data about its users, including children under 18, in advertising on the site. The changes are scheduled to go into effect later this week, but the coalition says they violate a 2011 order and settlement with the FTC over user privacy.
If you've been following the IFA conference in Berlin, you may have caught on to this already, but if not, curved, 4K, or rather UHD, are the new TV buzzwords coming out of IFA. These are often paired with the older buzzword OLED. Sony's only one for three, though, with its curved 65-inch HD TV that is not OLED, but costs $3,999. So they're missing the, like, huge price as well. Shipping this autumn, Sony's 4K TVs, they do have some, dropped price. The 55-inch XBR55X900A will sell for $3,999, and the 65-inch XBR65X900A, love those snappy TV titles, for $5,499. Sony also launched its Video Unlimited 4K service for the Sony FMP X1 4K media player owners, both of you. It has TV shows for $3.99 and films to rent for $7.99 or purchase for $24.99, including the complete Breaking Bad series in 4K once that series is done airing.
I wonder if that was shot in 4K. MailPipe, a crowdfunded email client, found that $45,000 worth of contributions were frozen by PayPal. MailPipe is currently building an email client that lets users control their email and keep it local instead of using something like Google or Microsoft servers. PayPal said it would unfreeze MailPipe's money after 1 year or if there is a verifiable 1.0 release of MailPipe. MailPipe's money could be also unfrozen if it can provide PayPal with an itemized budget and development goal dates.
All right. Good to know. I may have to do that myself someday. Joining us now to discuss the stories of the day, gathering around the round table, is Tim Stevens of CNET. Congratulations on the new job, Tim.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Good to have you with us as usual. It's been a while, so we're glad, very happy to have you back. Let's start by talking about the BlackBerry sale. Wall Street Journal reports BlackBerry board members want fast action process. In other words, they want to get this thing sold as soon as possible. Wall Street Journal says the Canada Pension Plan, the Bain Capital are considering bids, as well as some Asian tech companies, including Chinese smartphone and computer maker Lenovo. Huawei is not one of those. Reuters reports that Huawei board member Chen Lifang said, "No, we have not considered an acquisition. We want to rely on ourselves." So she said, that's out. Huawei is not in the bidding. Bert Nordberg, the former Sony Ericsson executive, now board member of BlackBerry, said recently, we mentioned this on an earlier show, that BlackBerry might be better off as a niche maker of mobile hardware. They might sell off other pieces like Enterprise Server, BlackBerry Messenger. All right. So really, this has been a long process. We've talked about this ad nauseum. Place your bets, folks. Who buys BlackBerry and what parts? Is it go in whole or is it go in part? Tim, let's start with you.
Well, there are basically three parts of BlackBerry, the way I look at it. You've got the hardware side, you know, the phones themselves, which have the great keyboards and that everybody loves. There's the services side, BlackBerry Enterprise Service, which is what handles a lot of the push email notifications and that kind of thing. And then there's also QNX, which is what BlackBerry 10 is built upon, but it is this operating system that runs everything from fighter jets to nuclear reactors. And that's a huge business all in and of itself. So, you know, I would likely see the services and the hardware going together. And if somebody could get QNX as well, I think that would be a great bargain because QNX is a very attractive platform for a variety of reasons. But, you know, if I had to put my money down, I'd say probably Lenovo would be the one to get the most out of this investment because Lenovo is trying to make a play here in the U.S. in the smartphone market. And to be able to pick up a, you know, a well-known brand like BlackBerry would be great. And, of course, BlackBerries and ThinkPads go together like peanut butter and chocolate or any other two things that go very well together. So, you know, those two brands, I think, would be very well suited for each other.
Yeah, two
blackberries and ThinkPads go together like blackberries and ThinkPads.
Yeah, great keyboards and, well, sort of great keyboards, which might be irrelevant at this point on BlackBerry because the Q10 didn't do so well. But I would probably go with Tim's suggestion of Lenovo, but I'm going to stick to my prediction of last year, Dell, even though there's fighting to go private.
Is that your prediction?
That Dell would buy RIM back then by BlackBerry because they just seemed to go well together because they're both kind of flailing around. And I'm like, these two flailers should get together.
But Dell can't even buy itself.
Well, the thing is, that's supposed to end hopefully by the end of next month or this month. So if they can go private, they can do a crazy move like this to go with Dell because they are also enterprise-based. And I think enterprises and services, I mean, handsets and services would fit in well with Dell. Not QNX, really. But that, I think, could work. But Tim's probably right. Lenovo makes the most sense when it comes to this acquisition.
What about the whole Amazon acquisition? Remember that whole story? Yeah. He buys newspapers. Why not? Why not keyboards?
Old antiquated things.
It's a perfect fit. It's the web 1.0 of phones. I actually don't think that that's the craziest thing ever said. Still,
no.
But
it's not.
I was trying to go out on a limb a little bit.
It's an interesting idea. I don't think that the branding quite would line up there because BlackBerries are, you know, very much enterprise focused. And if Amazon does launch a phone, it would probably be a more consumer focused thing, much like the Kindle Fire has been, that kind of thing. But it certainly would be an interesting way for Amazon to kind of jumpstart their smartphone hopes and be a great way for any new manufacturer to kind of get a lot of carrier partnerships, which is one of the biggest stumbling blocks in getting released here in the U.S. is getting partnerships with Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile and everybody else. So, you know, making this BlackBerry acquisition would get their foot in the door with all those carriers pretty quickly.
I wonder who's going to get BlackBerry Messenger, because I feel like Nordberg specifically really is pushing that. And it may not end up being that way, but really pushing it as buy half the business, which is focused on hardware, and buy the Messenger service. And there are lots of companies that would like to jumpstart a Messenger service or supplement an existing Messenger service.
How about Apple?
Apple. Well,
they could fix their Messenger service.
They could use some iMessage sync capabilities.
Yeah. I don't know if they would ever admit that their service was bad enough to buy something like BBM. That's
the
problem.
Don't have to admit it. Just
probably
make it
cost
better.
Too much. They like to buy unknown things for cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Google, Dr. Mom threw out Google as a possibility. They've got cash to spend, but for some reason that just doesn't strike me as likely. Maybe Yahoo suddenly gets a messenger service going.
Well, they have Yahoo Messenger. That's still a thing.
Yeah. Well, exactly, but you could juice it. I mean,
sure.
There's a declining but large number of people using BlackBerry Messenger in there. I do think that the Canada Pension Board is going to buy something though, just to make sure that they keep something in Waterloo, like that for some reason, and it's just a gut feeling, strikes me as one of the most likely people to come away with a piece. It's like a rummage sale. They're going to like pick whatever's left over at the end of the day for cheap.
Maybe we should pool our money and pick up some part of the company. Is there anything that strikes your eye?
Yeah. It's not a bad idea.
The playbook division.
I like QNX.
Oh, wait. QNX would be what I'd go for sure. I think that's got the most legs of anything there, I think.
All right, you and I, Tim, we'll pull this together. And Sarah,
we'll talk after.
Yeah, jump in. Let's talk about what Lenovo's doing now, as we have decided, apparently, buying BlackBerry.
Yeah, so Lenovo's thinking the future of laptops is in convertibles. The executive director of Lenovo Business Group, Nick Reynolds, says Lenovo's goal is to reinvent the traditional clamshell laptop and make multi-mode devices the norm. So think like the yoga here. Lenovo thinks that people want to make their devices into tablets and then use them as laptops. Lenovo right now is the number one PC maker in the world. It's got a 45% market share of the Windows 8 convertible tablet market. The company introduced the ThinkPad Yoga. Now, this is the first ThinkPad Yoga. They've had yoga lines before. That's on the IdeaPad line. It has a 12.5-inch display, can have up to 1 terabyte of storage, an Intel Core i7 if you want it in there, and it's got a really cool, different system for its keyboard. Now, if you ever used a yoga and you flipped it backwards, you always felt the keys at the end there. What happens is the keyboard tray itself actually lifts up, and it gives you somewhat of a relatively flat surface instead of that weird feeling of a keyboard back there. Lenovo also introduced the Flex 20, a 19.5-inch all-in-one PC that's designed to sit flat on a table. They're calling it something like a coffee table computer, I guess. HP also introduced a new all-in-one called the Recline. Now, this one kind of looks like the standard all-in-one with a big big foot there, but the hinge is really special. It allows the entire screen to be brought towards you, so it can lean off the desk, or you can flick the screen back and you can lay it flat. So it kind of looks like a tablet that's being propped up. It's another gigantic device. 23 and 27 inch models. They'll cost $1,350 and $1,400. Tim, is this the future computers, really, like tablets first and then they're like a laptop and desktop?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, the future of computers is probably not really a computer. So this is kind of the transition that we're beginning to see. But Lenovo's definitely been the most successful when it comes to these hybrid machines that are trying to do two things at once. The Yoga's been a very successful product for them. And I don't think that anybody else can really say that they've had a very successful hybrid device like that. So these new Yogas look great. I think the ThinkPad Yoga looks fantastic as well. And the keyboard tray that you mentioned should be an interesting thing. I'd like to see how that feels myself. But I think Lenovo's really making a strong push because they know that they need to. This is definitely the way that things are going. Microsoft's not going to stop pushing the touch interface for Windows, and people are not going to stop buying tablets. So if they want to keep the PC relevant for as long as they can, which of course they do, this is the way they got to go. So I think it's pretty interesting. It's still very fascinating for me to watch all these different shapes and all these different types of devices. You know, it's the most exciting innovation we've seen in the PC space for quite a while when it comes to form factor anyway.
I kind of love that recline, just because it gives you so many different angles. If you're sitting at a desk for a while, it's large enough to be it looks like a desktop PC, mm-hmm. right? I think that on-screen keyboard looks a little ridiculous. But otherwise, I just like the idea of being able to change angle. You know, your neck's not going to be at the same exact place all day. You can sort of look up, look down.
So you think for ergonomics, it's pretty awesome. It's just weird to see what
keyboard is still weird.
What PCs have become. Right?
Yeah.
I used to have, like, you know, towers and such, and now it's like, okay, everything's an all-in-one. And now what we're excited about is the hinge. Like, that's what it's like, oh, great, I can put this. Now I can put it in my lap.
The angle is all new.
The hinge is the new thing.
What excites me is that ThinkPad Yoga lift and lock. I've liked the idea, and I've played with a couple of these IdeaPad Yogas, but the weird keyboards on the back thing always bothered me. So that idea of that the kind of moving up so that it's flush when it's reclined back, and it being a ThinkPad with a 1 terabyte drive inside, that's really appealing. We didn't get a release date on these, though, did we?
I don't think so. I can look into that.
Yeah, I didn't think so either, but those... I'm really excited about the ThinkPad Yoga, actually.
That was
12.5-inch display is a little small for me, but...
I've tested out a bunch of Yoga laptops, convertibles, whatever you want to call them, for before you buy, and that was always my big issue with it, is that weird keyboard that when you're holding it, you feel the keyboard on the back, and that's strange. And the fact that Lenovo has great keyboards, it's another weird issue. Like, you don't want to remove the keyboard, and they don't want to apparently have the tear off the monitor, have a tablet thing. That's a small innovation that should be on pretty much anything that has this kind of form factor. But as we talked about this, I'm realizing that the hinge is the thing that's getting us excited. That's really sad.
It all hinges on that, is what you're saying.
No, that's what you're saying.
Golf clap in what you said.
Words in his mouth. All right, let's take a new path and talk about the social networking app that now allows a little more privacy.
Yes, Path. Path is just continues to upset me by adding too many features. Okay, so there are a couple things that Path has announced. This, of course, is the private social network where you can only have up to 150 friends, which, if you know, as it applies to most people, is more friends than you would actually have in real life. But the whole idea is it's not about gaining a huge amount of followers. It's about being yourself and being in a safe place with all your buddies. Private sharing is something that Path announced. So you can now share moments with just some of those 150 friends or however many friends you have on Path. They're called, the idea is that it maybe, I don't know, I've got something to share where I say, it's just for my five best friends. I add a little lock to the post. All of my friends know that it's locked because they see a little lock icon, but they can also see who else was part of that small group. So, you know, it's probably designed to help people who think, well, I don't know about Path. I'm friends with some people who I'm not really that close with. Then there's the inner circle, which is another feature, and that actually lets you, it's almost like a Google Plus circle that allows you to say, these are the 10 people I designate to be absolutely the closest people to me. Or maybe it's a family circle within your Path experience. Inner circle works the same way, except that you don't have to add those people every time you post something. Okay, so that's fine. You can also filter your home feed to show updates from your inner circle. Maybe you're like, Path is really noisy. I really just want to see updates from the people I care about the most. Now there's also premium subscriptions. So if you're a subscriber on iOS, it's $4.99 for 3 months or $15 for a year. On Android, it's sort of the same pricing, $1.99 a month or $15 for a year. Premium subscribers, you get unlimited access to filters and stickers and early access to shop items, that sort of thing. So, hey, you know, premium subscribers, I get it. Path wants to make money. The thing about these inner circles and private sharing options, though, that really annoy me is that Path started as this place where you could only have 50 friends. Back when Path first launched, and everybody said, this is too limiting, this is not how social networking works, we can't deal with it. So Path relented and said, okay, let's make it 150. But now they're just adding more layers on top of this to make it the social network that they wanted to make it in the first place, because they realize that people don't want to share that much with 150 people. That's not actually how private sharing works. So it bothers me, because it's a simple app that now is complicated and bothersome, and I'm going to be looking at these lock icons all the time. Tim, do you share my ire?
I would actually be a little bit more pessimistic, even. And you know, to me, this feels like Path is beginning to set up the sort of privacy filters that you would need if you want to go even bigger, much bigger. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see that 150 number expanding greatly in the not too distant future, because now they've got the controls where you can set up private lists, much like you have in Facebook or Google Plus, and share things with subsets of friends, which then opens the door for you having all the friends you want to, and then just sharing with, you know, a subset based on whatever it is you're sharing. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see that 150 number growing quite a bit in the not too distant future.
That lock icon is clumsy. I just tried it just now while we were talking about this story, and I think I shared a post with myself. I didn't see how I was actually able to put the people in there. I actually like the inner circle idea of saying, you know, sometimes there's just like my close friends that I want to let somebody know something about. I think that's useful and fairly simple and easy to understand. But this whole, like, without having a circles thing, yeah, I think I agree with you, Sarah. It just makes it too complex.
It seems like they're making themselves again. Like Path used to, like you were saying, had a small set of people, and you're supposed to be sharing like the most private things you have with these people because you trust them. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you're going to add to 150, or if you go beyond that, that's strange. And now they add this circle thing where now people are going to ask for a second circle, third circle. It's going to end up like Facebook with groups, and you're going to have the Google style circles. It's adding layers of complexity that Path itself doesn't necessarily need. But when it comes to, if they have enough feature bloat, they can start charging you for the features that you might want, I would think. Like, let's say if you want to have four circles or whatever, now you're willing to pay that little extra feature for that feature, because they've slowly crept their way into that. But
that's part of that premium subscription, right?
Yeah, that could be part of that eventually. So that's kind of an oddball thing. Maybe it's just a growth strategy, but I don't use Path that way. I try to keep it under like 50, 40 people.
Well, that's the point. I mean, that's the whole thing that Path has been selling to us the whole time, is it's the safe place to share your life with family and friends. Share your path in life, I think, is like their tagline. But they realize that people don't use it that way. They have friends there that are, I don't know, you met once at a party, or it's like, hey, I'm just going to add all the other people that use Path. A lot of people don't use Path, so they're not necessarily the closest people to you. And then you see people not coming back. And so Path says, now you can have an inner circle. It's like, that is what Path's supposed to be. It's supposed to be your inner circle. That's the whole point. Stop it.
Well, and they may be just responding to the general need for privacy in the world right now, especially with all the Snowden leaks and everything like that. There's a new survey out today. Sarah, Pew Internet Studies says half the people either care or don't care about privacy.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's sort of a troubling number, really, because you say half people care, but then half the people don't care. Yeah, Pew Internet Study surveyed 792 people via phone interviews. It was conducted by Princeton Survey Research Associates. These studies are always pretty interesting, because it shows not only what people are, you know, worried about or concerned about, but also how they're being proactive against worries and concerns. So 86% of those polled say that they have taken specific steps to protect themselves. You know what the number one thing was? Clearing browser cookies. Also things like encrypting email, or avoiding use of their real name on social networks, or spoofing IP addresses. All were other alternatives. 55% say they've taken steps to elude monitoring. And of course, the number one concern with who might be spying on me is hackers. Most people are concerned about hackers. But then that was followed by advertisers. Then that was followed by friends. And then way down at the bottom, law enforcement and government. So at least of those polled, just under 800 people say, yeah, we're mostly concerned about hacking and criminal activity, government stuff. We're not really all that concerned about it. 59% say we don't think it's possible to ever be completely anonymous online. Smart people. 68% say current laws don't go far enough to protect online privacy, which is interesting considering that if you feel that way, you're still not really concerned about law enforcement. Okay. And then 21% say, well, I've had my email or my social network account compromised. 12% say I've been stalked or harassed online. 6% say my reputation was hurt by something that was put online about me. Tim, do any of these numbers seem surprising to you, or is this just a growing pessimistic world where none of us trust the internet?
Yeah, I was actually surprised that that 50% number wasn't higher, especially given all the NSA information lately. And I was actually very surprised, like you, that the fear of government tracking wasn't higher on the list. I mean, obviously, we should all be concerned about phishing and hackers and all that sort of thing for sure. But I think that people definitely have a reason to be concerned about government tracking as well. The 86% number, I think that's pretty encouraging. You know, I think that number is pretty sharply up over a couple of years, and that's great. But it still means 14% of people are forgetting to sign out when they finish checking their email at the library and checking in for their flight at the airport and that kind of thing, which, you know, that can go a little bit higher, but 86%, I'd say, is a pretty good number.
All these numbers surprise me in their largeness. I have generally operated on the assumption that most of the people, none of you in our audience, but most of the people out there just don't think about this stuff. So even with the lag you would experience from the Snowden revelations affecting people's actual perceptions and responses, I think this is a heartening number, especially that 86% number, and provides a clear need for someone to crack the encrypted email on the web. There's a ton of projects out there trying to be the project that does this, that's open source, that's secure, and it's encrypted, and it's a tough thing to do. But if these numbers are any indication, it's worth doing.
I wonder if these people aren't worried because they know the government's tracking them. Like, we don't have to worry about it. We know it's already happening. So I am worried about these faceless hackers that are somewhere. I don't know where they are, and they might be coming into my machine. And I don't know if advertisers are planting cookies. But I know the government's doing it, so that's okay. So maybe they're just not putting their worry. Because they
21%
know.
Felt safer that the government is backing up all their data.
Well, sure, you can't worry about something that you know is happening, absolutely. So, yeah, absolutely. Well, now we all know that we're being tracked, we're being hacked by the government.
Like
so,
worrying
yeah,
about the
I
winter
guess,
coming.
No worries.
Yeah, I just want the restore button from the NSA so that I can bring all my stuff back.
I just like how a much larger number than government was friends. I am worried about what my friends are getting from my personal
information. A lot of pranksters, apparently. Yeah. I could see that.
See, that's why you have to bring down your number on Path, because a lot of those people, they're just screenshotting everything you say. They're going to make Tumblr accounts about it. Ruin your reputation.
Most people don't feel like the government is going to be interested in them. They may be outraged at the violation of trust, but they really aren't worried when it comes down to it of what the government's going to find. They are much more worried about being embarrassed in front of their friends. That makes sense to me. All right, let's talk about the Apple of China. Xiaomi, trying to beat Apple to the punch, introducing a smart TV. This follows up on something they had called the Xiaomi Box that they announced earlier this year. The Mi TV, or the Xiaomi TV, 47-inch LCD 3D TV with Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, comes in 6 colors. It's 2 centimeters at the thinnest. 8.4 millimeter bezel available, like I said, 6 colors, and runs the Mi UI Android. So this is a smart TV, but it's running a fork of Android. Has a quad core Snapdragon 600 processor. Dogs love it. 2 gigabytes of RAM, 8 gigabytes of hard drive space or storage space. I think it's probably flash drive space. Dual band Wi-Fi and 2,999 Chinese yen, or $490. It's coming in mid-October. Now, we also got a new Mi 3, and that, if you haven't heard about this, these are the phones that take China by storm. They sell them for a small amount of money because they say they're going to make the money back on selling software and services, and they always sell out. They have a limited number of them, and they sell out like crazy. It's a 5-inch 1080p LCD screen, a 16-gigabyte version, Sony camera that's 13 megapixels. It's got some haptics in there. Different versions will either have a Tegra 4 or a Snapdragon 800 processor. It's thin, 8.1 millimeters. It's light, 145 grams. And here's the cool thing. You can touch it with wet fingers or through gloves. They have this ultra-sensitive touchscreen was one of their big wow factors. It's still very plasticky. In late June, the head of Xiaomi promises a metal phone next time. Didn't see much out of Hugo Barra, the Google employee who just joined Xiaomi. But looking at this phone and seeing how they're trying to put some wow factor in there, they're trying to make it have some pretty good specs, keep the price cheap. This thing's going to be the equivalent of $410 for the 64 gig version. Hugo Barra on board is the international person. They may seem like a cute Chinese product right now, but they're insanely popular. Tim, do you think this magic can spread to the rest of the world?
And they're making big investments, as you can tell, with bringing on Hugo and other marketing investments as well. They're definitely going to push this company brand as hard as they can. And I think that they've got some great products. We've been seeing them develop incredibly quickly over the past couple of years from making iPhone knockoffs a couple of years ago to making some really nice handsets. And this new one looks great. I mean, the only thing it doesn't really have is any sort of standout feature that'll make it stand out from the crowd of the Galaxies and everything else that's on the market. But it looks like a very nice phone. And this new TV looks fantastic, too. I mean, that's a $400 price for a fairly large, fairly smart television. That's a great price. If they can get it here in U.S. stores for something similar to that price, that would be probably a knockout device. It would sell very well, I think, and especially as we're moving into, a lot of talk about the Apple TV, as you mentioned. So, yeah, I think they've definitely got the potential. But as we were talking about before, they've got to get the carrier partnerships right to get that smartphone here in stores. But even if they don't, I mean, that's a $400 for a 64 gigabyte phone unsubsidized. That would be a fantastic price that, it's not something that your general consumer would go for. But I think that a lot of other people would probably think about buying this phone. They'd have to buy it separately, of course. But if it were compatible with AT&T and T-Mobile and some popular bands, $400 for a 64 gigabyte smartphone with nice design and nice specs, I think a lot of people would go for that.
I think the thing that Xiaomi is trying to make stand out with their Android phones is their customization, because a lot of those devices look to me kind of like iPhone. Some of them look like iPhone knockoffs, but some of them still retain a lot of the Android features that you want. So maybe that's the way they can differentiate themselves, because we've got Samsung and they've got TouchWiz. We've got HTC with their Sense UI, but Xiaomi's, they call it the Mi UI. That thing allows the customer to do a lot more things. And that might be a hook that could be better for everybody, because when you see that phone, you want to be wowed. You want to go, oh, what's that? What's that? And then you can have your own phone like that too.
Absolutely. And it is a very nice looking UI. It's a very easy to use UI as well. And that too basically started off as kind of a knockoff of iOS. It had icons that looked very similar to iOS, and functionality that was very similar to iOS. But that too has evolved very quickly. And it's probably one of the nicest UI overlays on top of Android. It is one of the heaviest, I would say, but it is very nice, and it definitely does make it easier to use, as you mentioned. So, yeah, it's a great package overall, and I think they could have a lot of success if they can get really good devices like this in U.S. stores at low cost. I think they'll have success.
I like the idea of different colors on televisions. I mean, is any other company doing that?
Samsung did it for a little bit.
Did they?
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't want to say that nobody's doing it, but certainly it's not normal.
It's not anything I've ever seen before. If you go to Xiaomi's TV
silver
site.
And black, that's it.
What's that?
You can sometimes get silver and black, but that's usually the extent of your options. And then there's the Philips Ambilight technology, which will have the LEDs on the back, which will give you color projected from your TV. But to actually change the bezel color, no, that's quite rare.
I mean, I don't know if I want a yellow TV, but I think it's kind of cool that you have the option. Yeah, people who take decorating seriously, have your TV match your drapes. And then get another one in 2 years when you change your mind.
I'll be curious if, ZTE has made some headway. Huawei has made some headway, but they're certainly not popular options. They're seen as bargain phones. But if this came in as the bargain phone to beat them, I think they could eat their lunch here in the United States. And it'll be very interesting to see what Apple announces next week as far as inexpensive phones and what markets those inexpensive phones might end up being in. Let's finish up talking about TVs again. And we mentioned Xiaomi with their Android-based TV, the MIUI-based TV. They're trying to get people to use those apps on the televisions, at least make it easier for developers, right, Ayaz?
Yeah, but this is not as exciting as colored bezels, I will admit that. But the Smart TV Alliance has launched the Developer Support Program, and this is going to allow developers to run their Smart TV apps through a single approval system. Then those apps, if approved, would be compatible with every Alliance-compatible TV. So the idea is developers would make one app and would run on a bunch of different televisions. The Alliance has LG, TP Vision, Toshiba, and Panasonic, a total of 19 members in the Alliance there. The Smart TV Alliance also posted a new SDK, version 2.5, that allows for multi-screen integration with mobile apps. The next version of the SDK is expected to bring ultra HD support. Tim, are we finally going to see people using those apps and we'll see the death of set-top boxes, or is this just something that's there for now?
Man, I hope so. I have such high optimism for any sort of alliance like this. The smart TV market is way more fragmented even than the smartphone market or the smart car market. You know, if you want an app on a Samsung TV, that's great. If you want to get it on an LG TV, then you need to completely rewrite it from the ground up and resubmit it. And that's a huge barrier of entry for these companies, many of whom are very small. And you know, you can find dozens of great apps that are available on one platform but not on the other. So, you know, the potential to get rid of all that would be great. And if there could be one smart TV platform and one set of apps that would work across them all, would be amazing. The problem is the alliance only has three members right now, and of them, only two are, you know, what I would call a major player. It's LG and Toshiba are the two big ones. And there's also TP Vision, which makes Philips TVs in some markets. So, you know, we're not looking at a Sony and a Samsung and some other big players signed on. If they would sign on too, that would be great. But I think, unfortunately, they're probably going to have a steep hill to climb ahead of them to get all the manufacturers on board, because they want to have their own proprietary systems. They want to have their own proprietary selections of apps. And that's going to be a big problem for them. But if they can do it, if this can be the alliance that brings all the smartphones together, the one alliance to rule your living room, that'd be a great thing.
I just don't think this is going to be the platform. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be doing this or shouldn't be pursuing it. I think it's the right way to go as far as people making apps for TVs. But I am really convinced that there's a reason that VCR TV combos weren't ever a huge market, because people don't want to be locked in with their device connected to their television. They're going to keep a television a lot longer than they might keep a set-top box or a device like that. And I think unless somebody comes along and really makes the smart TV platform work a lot better, and standardization is a step towards that, so this is a positive, I think Apple TVs, Rokus, Xbox 360s, Sony PS4s, Simple.TV, all these others are going to be preferable options for people. Even TiVos and Vudu boxes, although I don't think Vudu makes the box anymore. But those are where people are going to spend their money. I think fewer people are going to use that app platform that's in their television.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with smart TVs in general has been just underpowered processors in there, because these apps were kind of add-ons, these little like extra little bells and whistles. But performance was terrible. That's why you want to go to a set-top box like a Roku 3 or something like that. And the other thing is, I thought Android would kind of go into this. We saw the other TVs. Lenovo also has an Android-powered TV. That could have apps. Why didn't that take off as an actual platform? We've seen lots of different things trying to vie for the television, but it seems like set-top boxes are going to be there for like forever.
Well, they're just a better option right now. Maybe not forever, but I have a smart TV to Samsung. I think when I first set it up, I clicked through the menu a couple times and I was like, I don't want to do this. I'm just going to access Netflix the way I've always been accessing it, either via my Roku or my Apple TV, because that's just what I know. I mean, it took a long time, and many people still use their cable on-screen menus and have their big clunky cable boxes. And, you know, it's sort of like, well, that's just what I do and that's what I know. So it's going to be hard to get anybody to really get on board behind a lot of these smart TV options, because they're just not really fun and joyful to navigate.
Yep. They've definitely been very slow and very sluggish to use and very cumbersome as well. They've actually gotten a lot better over the past 12 months. The TVs that are coming out or that have come out this year are hugely improved over the TVs that came out last year. So they're still learning. They're still making things better. But ultimately, because there's such quick innovation on these TVs, for the most part, they get obsolete just as quickly as smartphones. But the problem is we're changing platforms drastically every year. So, you know, if you buy a two-year-old Android smartphone, you can still download the latest apps. If you buy a two-year-old smart TV, you probably won't get any app updates for us. Samsung does have a program where you can kind of plug in a new box in the back, and basically it's like the smart portion of the brain can be kind of hot swapped in and out, which is I think the only manufacturer doing that sort of thing. But in general, this sort of thing would definitely help. But to be, I think most people right now are leaning toward their Xboxes or their PlayStations or the Rokus or whatever else to do this kind of thing. And I think it'll still take a while for people to understand that smart TVs can be quick and can be good. But like you said, Tom, people don't buy TVs that often.
And I think the things like the Roku Stick or the Chromecast are examples of a better option than that sort of brain replacement that you're talking about, which is a little clunky. And I think a lot of people look at that and say, oh, I don't know, that seems dangerous to be pulling apart out of my television.
Yeah,
whereas a Chromecast that you just
expensive
plug.
And proprietary.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on to the randomizer. We conducted a straw poll with our live audience today, and in the number two slot, the new Yahoo logo got a respectable 35% of the vote, and we'll have that link, or you can just go to yahoo.com and look at it. What we're going to talk about, though, got 65% of the vote, the dexterous robotic hand, an attempt to make an open advanced prosthetic that is literally 100 times cheaper than the current versions. It's not so much of a technological breakthrough in how it works. It uses electrodes to read the muscle signals and then control the prosthetic hand. But it's using cheaper materials, 3D printers, and a more efficient way of creating the hand to bring it down from $11,000 for the market-leading model back in 2010, according to TechCrunch, to 700 pounds. If you back Joel Gibbard's open hand project and you put 700 pounds in, you can get the full prosthetic version of the device. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And he wants to make it even cheaper.
Sorry, I'm transfixed by this video. So
yeah,
cool.
He's working with a chef who has been using a hook, and he's replaced the hook. And that's another thing, is it's hot swappable. He can use the same sleeve that he uses for his hook to use with this this prosthetic hand, the dexterous robotic hand. And it's got full articulation. It has sensors that will, you know, keep it from gripping something too hard.
You know, there was some documentary I saw a while ago, and it was about somebody who was a climber and had lost a leg, or maybe even both. And there were, depending on the intensity of the climb, or, you know, the sort of mountainous region that you were going to try to conquer, there were different kinds of prosthetic legs that he would that he would attach. And I love the idea of something like this, because if it's 100 times cheaper to have a variety of different prostheses, then that just improves the quality of life so much more. Because I think for many people, I mean, this is all a cost prohibitive thing.
And Gibbard got a Bachelor of Engineering in Robotics from the University of Plymouth. That he's an engineer. He just wants to make this happen. This was the project he was working on at school, and he wants to carry it forward. Pretty cool stuff.
I love the 3D printing aspect of this. This is just like further proof of the awesome things that we are in store for. And I mean, obviously starting immediately, but in the very near term, the cool things that are kind of empowered by the fact that you can print something like a prosthetic hand. That's awesome.
I totally melted my hand last night. I had to print a new one.
Sorry, just want to say that he's not using a particularly high-end 3D printer either. It looks like a fairly inexpensive consumer model that he's using, too. It's not, you know, like a high-end 3D systems model or something like that. So, you know, maybe we're not too far away from being able to print these ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no kidding. All right, let's check what's on the calendar. Got a few interesting items today.
Would you like a Galaxy Note 3 or perhaps a Galaxy Gear? If so, tomorrow is pre-order day for the U.S. Verizon is announcing the pre-order days will start at 9 a.m. Eastern time tomorrow, September 6th. My Open ID, remember My Open ID? I do. It'll be turned off on February 1st, 2014.
So sad.
Yeah, it is sad.
It is.
All good things must come to an end, I guess. And Microsoft says the company will support the Xbox 360 until 2016. So you've got some time before you start panicking and complaining.
Start getting your complaints
down. It'll change its mind on 2016 when it goes, oh, yeah, we'll keep supporting you for another 5 years. Don't worry about it.
Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
A message from Derek. It says, hey, TNT crew, in regards to your discussion about Sony PlayStation yesterday, I would argue that especially in comparison to Microsoft, Sony has kept their focus very much on gamers with the PS4, while Microsoft has been trying to position the Xbox One as a device for everyone in the household, as well as a non-gaming entertainment device. Sony has continued to reiterate that the PS4 as being a device for the gamer addressing gamer concerns, like used games from the very beginning, dedicating time on indie title development, etc. Another consideration for Sony moving forwards an Oculus Rift-like product is that one of their partners, CCP Games, has been creating a new multiplayer game on that platform. There are signs of interest from third-party developers. I'm sure Sony would prefer to keep more dollars/games on their platform, even if it makes making a new device/extension.
You know, Derek's not wrong that that's what Sony's been doing. On the other hand, it's a little bit like Democrats versus Republicans, not to get too political, but they aren't as different as maybe they would like you to think. In the end, PS4, the Xbox One, share more in common than they have in difference. So this is Sony's spin, and I think it's a smart one.
Got another email from Techno Squid. This is very interesting. It says, when I first heard that KitKat was the name chosen for the next Android release, the first thing I thought was, this is going to be huge in Japan. There's a lot of affinity for the KitKat brand in Japan. It's the number one selling chocolate bar. It's also given as good luck gifts, especially among students, because the name is reminiscent of the phrase Kitokatsu, roughly translated to mean sure to win. He says, I know we all like to think marketing has little effect on us, but I can't help but think that this association between Japanese youth's beloved KitKat and Android is exactly the kind of mindshare bolstering partnership Google would love to have in a wealthy and tech-obsessed country. Still, the USB debugging connected notification icon probably shouldn't be a KitKat bar Android, just to keep the branding at arm's length. As Tom mentioned briefly, they have some really bizarre flavors, which are mostly seasonal limited editions, the strangest of which I've had are almond tofu, edamame, white grape, and ginger ale.
Ginger ale?
Oh, gosh, gross. I used to import some every year for my trick-or-treaters just to give them something unique. That is fascinating. And probably, he's probably right.
A huge in Japan.
Mommy, what's a potato Kit Kat?
Give me an Android. Almond tofu.
Yeah.
Is that like oatmeal beige?
Right. One of the colors.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us.
Yesterday. Never mind. Jeez. Quickly we forget.
People, please. That brings us to an end of a lovely tech news today. As always, a pleasure to have you, Tim Stevens of CNET.com. What are you doing over there? What are you going to be up to?
So I'm going to be working on a longer form feature content. I'm going to be digging in on to tell the stories of products, kind of how they came to be, the bumps along the way, what sort of features got left on the drawing board, that sort of thing, and doing a lot more long form work to see how products kind of fit in your life. You know, this industry is very fast moving, and we're all very quick in the industry to move on to what's new and exciting, but we forget about the products that people are actually using every day. So I'm going to couldn't be focusing on that sort of thing, but also be doing some events work. So you'll be seeing more of me at the Apple 10th Apple event. The September 10th Apple event.
It's Apple 10th now. You're right.
We should actually just change the name of September to Apple, because really that's the most
pretty much. September. Tim Stevens on Twitter, Tim_Stevens. Thank you so much. Pleasure as always. Also, folks, don't forget to follow us on our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. Get in there and vote. The more votes we see on a story, the more we know you're interested. And if you don't like a story, you can vote it down. That's the beauty of Reddit. PCGuy8088, for instance, submitted the Facebook privacy story. It was in the news fuse today. And lots of people voted on it. That helped us make the decision. So get in there and take advantage. TechNewsToday.reddit.com. Don't forget, you can always find us at twit.tv/TNT. Email us, tnt@twit.tv, and give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. It's Friday tomorrow, and it's a classic Friday with Darren Kitchen as our guest and Len Peralta drawing the stories, illustrating Tech News Today. We'll see you tomorrow.